7BR Part Heard.
Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Eleanor Day, Chambers Paralegal, and today, in the first week of the UK's Disability History Month, I'm joined by Dr. Gregory Burke to discuss his path to the bar and what progress has been made in the fight for the rights of disabled people. Before coming to the bar, Gregory founded the UK's largest disability access information website, AccessAble, which now turns over £2.5 million a year and employs 50 people, recently celebrating its 20th anniversary. It currently serves 350 large businesses or organisations, including the English Premier League, M&S, Next, IKEA, a number of London boroughs, 85 universities and 65 NHS trusts. Gregory specialises in employment law for both claimants and respondents, and also personal injury and clinical negligence. Chambers and Partners notes that he is, quote, an accomplished advocate, recognised for his expertise in discrimination claims, in particular claims of disability discrimination, with strong knowledge of areas including unfair constructive dismissal, and that he has superb knowledge of discrimination law in particular, is a robust advocate, is good with clients, and is just outstanding when it comes to disability discrimination matters. And it is his outstanding work fighting for disabled people's rights at the bar and through his social entrepreneurship that has earned Gregory a place in the Shaw Trust Disability Power 100 for 2 years running, a list of the most influential disabled people in the UK. Gregory, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Before coming to the bar, you had a very successful career as founder of the UK's largest disability access information website, Accessible, formerly Disabled Go. What motivated this work?
Well, like most disabled people, I wasn't born with my disability. I acquired it out of the blue as a sportsman 16-year-old. And during a 3.5 year period, I was in hospital and rehabilitation, during which time I was washed, fed and gradually put back together. And as you can see, and as you know, Ellie, I've got an improving condition. And now some 30 years on, I'm fortunate enough just to have some residual mobility issues primarily. And I use a wheelchair or a scooter for walking anything other than a small distance. I call those hard yards. And I have a machine to help me breathe at night. And the reason that I share this quite personal information is to help non-disabled people realise the effects of disability or a disabling society. So it sounds a bit odd, but when I was in hospital, I realised I had multiple impairments. It was only when I was discharged that I realised I was disabled, because doing everyday things were fraught with difficulty and frustration. Just finding places where I could go, literally just things like, where can I get a haircut? How can I get in? Is there a lavatory that I can use? You know, where do I find an accessible dentist? And this sense of frustration and massive inconvenience just grew and grew. And what I wanted to know was whether these feelings and frustrations were shared by many more disabled people. So when I was a student, I went up and down the country to listen to disabled people. Why aren't we in education more? Why aren't we in employment more? Why aren't we down the pub more? And what came back from that was two key findings. One, society in general is largely inaccessible, slowly changing, still generally the case. And secondly, in a generally inaccessible society, there could be venues and services which are accessible to my own individual needs or your own individual needs, if only we knew about it. And that was the genesis of AccessAble.
And now what does AccessAble do?
Well, we provide very detailed access guides to venues and services across the UK. I mean, really detailed stuff from the surface that people go over. If you're a wheelchair user and it's gravel, you need to know. If you're a disabled walker and it's cobbles, how far do you have to walk to get into a particular venue? What's the door widths if you're using a particular type of wheelchair or scooter? What's the lighting like at reception if you rely on lip reading? What are the sounds and smells you'll encounter if you have a particular autistic traits, for example? So really detailed stuff. And the characteristic really is that all of this is grassroots up, involving disabled people on a pan-disability basis at every turn, thinking about what information we collect about all these different venues and services and how do we present it. So I'll tell you this, Ellie, some people think I've got a fetish about toilets, and they're absolutely right. I do, because it is absolutely vital. We collect over 200 pieces of information on toilets alone. And typically a detailed access guide to a venue will contain over 1,000 pieces of information. And we do places like theatres, cinemas, restaurants, florists, cafes, universities, hospitals, sports stadium, English Premier League, for example. And we have been fortunate enough that we've been very successful. And that is because the team that I have is absolutely brilliant.
And do you think part of what makes AccessAble such a success is, it seems to me that it really changes the kind of discourse around accessibility and disabled people's access, in that I feel like it shines a light on institutions and their responsibility and all the different ways in which they are achieving or are failing at making places accessible. And like you mentioned, disabled society rather than disabled people. Do you think that's an important part of the work?
I think it's an absolutely crucial part of the work. AccessAble corresponds to the social model of disability. So, I have difficulty getting out of bed. That's a result of my impairment. But the fact that I can't use transport easily, for example, or get into a place of work, that is society disabling me. But also, I mean, previous to AccessAble, access guides were really conceived in terms of what a wheelchair user could do, and assuming that all wheelchair users could do the same thing, right? But of course, disability is much richer and broader and more textured than that. And part of our work has been evangelizing to different institutions and organizations about this. I mean, we work with over 2/3 of London boroughs with an area-wide guide. We've got over 20,000 venues in London, for example. We work with 85 universities, nearly all the Russell Group, 65 NHS trusts, which are like small towns, and national chains like Marks and Spencer, Next, IKEA. And there's obviously an appetite for this information because 1.7 million disabled people use it each year. But crucially too, we provide information about how to get in and use and get around these venues. But we also provide information about how these organizations, these venues can improve their access.
So you're doing all this incredible work and you're very busy, and then you decide to add more to your plate by coming to the bar. What made you decide to do that?
Just masochistic tendency. Look, it sounds naive, I know. But I hope that I've established through my business career, I mean, AccessAble turns over 2.5 million a year, and I employ 50 people. And over the course of AccessAble's life, I've employed perhaps a couple of hundred people. So I'm not some ingenue, and I've been around the block. It sounds naive, but I wanted to be a barrister because I wanted to help people directly. And AccessAble helps people, millions of people, but I don't see them necessarily. And it's not that human connection. It's an absolute privilege to serve so many people through AccessAble, but it's a great, as great a privilege to serve individual people as a barrister or individual businesses as a barrister, because nobody wants to see me as a barrister because their life is going well. And I know what it's like to face enormous challenges and to be afraid of the day. And I see my job as a barrister to obviously be fully on top of the law, but to make that connection with the client, to understand where they're coming from, and then to be able to fully advise them. And because going through litigation is a difficult process for anybody, and I don't care how brave you think you are, I want to make sure that whether my client is a disabled person or whether it's an employer, or whoever, they are properly supported. And I feel that's a privilege.
And how do you think your lived experience has enabled you to do that?
Well, I know what it's like to experience discrimination. I'm not alone in that, of course, but I know that and I get it all the time. But I've also experienced what it's like to be an employer and an owner of an SME. I know what it's like to be under huge business pressure. and to make decisions which actually have consequences that you don't intend. So, of course, there's not equivalence between those two perspectives, discrimination and business pressures. But I thought that I could, and I think I do, or certainly I aim to, apply a degree of insight from both of these perspectives so that I can illuminate different sides of the same reality to for the benefit of disabled people and for employers.
You recently wrote a piece for Disability History Month, which includes a description of your experiences of travelling by train. And you mentioned some of the ways in which that kind of accessibility has improved over recent years. What do you think has driven that improvement, and where do you think there's still room for improvement?
Well, first of all, there's massive room for improvement. You can readily come across examples of disabled people being forced to relieve themselves, you know, in the clothes that they're in because of want of access to a lavatory on a train or at a platform, or they're let down at interchanges. And perhaps listeners don't fully appreciate that if you are, for example, a wheelchair user, to get on almost all trains and crucially get off almost all trains, you have to have a ramp access to get on and off. And if a lavatory in your carriage, for example, is out of order, it's not, you can't go along to the next carriage. And the amount of times that I've got onto a train and looked up to see the dreaded red sign with the line across that facility is out of action, the rising sense of panic that I feel, am I actually going to be able to hold on for 50 minutes or an hour, what have you, is that is disabling. But what I've learned about that is, you know, to reduce the level of care I have about what other people think. So if the worst comes to the worst, well, you know, it's happening to me. It's not happening to anybody else. And I would say to any disabled person who's listening to this, that it's a huge confidence barrier to go and use the trains and what have you. And I don't want to stress too much the difficulties of travel, because I really feel it's important that disabled people do have the confidence to travel, but we should be alive for the realities of it as well. But I find actually the kindness of strangers is almost limitless. I was going to a hearing a few years ago and my wheelchair decided it would totally stop. I use a battery powered wheelchair, power chair, and it decided it would stop working. And I had to ask strangers to push me. And I thought to myself, well, if the boot's on the other foot, I would be delighted to help. It costs me virtually nothing because it's not heavy. And nobody I asked even looked askance at me. Everybody did it. I had to ask about 7 or 8 people to finally get to where I wanted to go. These challenges can be overcome. But when I do travel with a non-disabled person by train, you know, with them for the first time, they are usually amazed at the number of hurdles that I encounter. Not that my experience is any different from many disabled people's. And many train stations are still inaccessible. But there have been improvements. What's driven those improvements has partly been legislation and regulations. Partly there's been a greater understanding that it's just not acceptable to have a 1950s approach to disabled people living in the back bedroom for the rest of their lives. I mean, there are 12 million disabled people in the UK with a spending power of 250 billion. And we are part of friendships and family circles. And we have an important contribution to make. And if you want to have a rich, diverse society, which is not susceptible to groupthink, and we all know the dangers of groupthink, was a 2008 crash, for example, you need to encourage that diversity. So I think those are the drivers for change, and not least disabled people who are not prepared to accept the rubbish. But I have to say, I lived in Worthing as a young man, and going to use the train stations there was really difficult because there were steps up and I'd go along in my wheelchair or scooter, and there's no way of letting somebody know that you need to get onto the train station. If you can't get up the steps, what do you do? There's no bell or anything. So again, I had to rely on the kindness of strangers to go up and talk to somebody to come back down. And they would come back down and they would take me through what was supposedly an accessible entrance, but it was a goods entrance, go through there. And then they would take me on this rather circumlocutious route involving goods lifts with heavy metal doors, outer doors and concertina doors thereafter to get into this goods lift, go down, go under the railway lines to get up to the platform. So quite an exhausting process. I was there fairly recently and seeing my dad, and the steps were gone. There was a really well-designed, beautiful ramp going in. Certainly from my perspective, it was very accessible. The lift had changed in just to an ordinary passenger lift, push button. I could do it by myself. And as I used that for the first time, I gave a prayer of thanks for the people and disabled advocates of the past who had really advocated for a more accessible, inclusive society. And you can say, well, you know, Access Able is doing very well and I'm able to be a barrister now. But I only have a modest claim on those achievements because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Absolutely. It's really heartening to hear and to think about all the work that's come before. But like you said, there is still so much more to do. I suppose that sort of links into the next question that I wanted to ask you, which is about the Equality Act and its 10-year anniversary, because the accompanying guidance to that said that it was designed with the aim of making the law easier to understand and strengthening protection. So I was wondering whether you think it's achieved those aims in respect of the rights of disabled people.
Well, it's a great question. And of course, it's also the 25th anniversary of the Disability Discrimination Act this year too. And that act was heralded as a great advance for disabled people's rights. And in many ways, it was. The Disability Rights Commission, the DRC, welcomed part three of that act, which is access to goods and services, saying it was the biggest change in consumer law for a generation. But unfortunately, that change has not been accompanied by sufficient enforcement. And this, I think, is the major deficiency. It was the case then, it's still the case today under the Equality Act 2010, that in most cases, it's for the disabled person themselves to bring a claim of discrimination in the county courts. And you know what this means, really, in practice, it's for a disabled person bringing a claim to fund their own litigation. And there are two main disincentives here. The first is that if a discrimination claim, disability discrimination claim, ends up in the fast track or the multi-track, and the disabled person does not qualify for legal aid, then they're at risk of an adverse costs order. And given that the damages recoverable for these claims tend to be small, but the costs incurred by the defendant tend to be significant, or may be significant at least, this operates as a real deterrent. So just to cut to the chase, the disabled person is at risk of losing a lot of money. And the availability of measures such as after the event insurance, that can be difficult to find. And the cost may also be prohibitive. So that is a significant challenge for disabled people to overcome. And the second impediment is that it's very difficult, and it may indeed be impossible, to find lawyers to act for you. And that's because damages are generally low. And if the case is on a contingent basis or conditional basis, on a CFA, for example, conditional fee agreement, then lawyers can't be confident that the clients will be able to pay the success fee if they win. So this has remained a significant disincentive, not just for disabled people to bring claims, but for businesses and service providers to make themselves fully accessible. And this again feeds back into the Access Able evangelism about the power of the disabled pound, but also how disabled people influence the spending of high-income associates. So if, a great example is Chambers booking its Christmas party. We book a venue, which I can get into. So one wheelchair user influencing the spend of, 130 people. Now, in personal injury claims, there's a provision called QOX, which stands for Qualified One-Way Cost Shifting. And this means that if you bring an honest personal injury claim and you conduct proceedings reasonably and you're unsuccessful in the litigation, then you're not liable to pay the costs of the defending party. It was recently argued that this provision should be applied to discrimination claims as well. But unfortunately, the High Court in the case of Esther Layton disagreed. For a range of reasons, including in the court's judgment that the current regime passed the test of proportionality and that insulating claimants from a cost risks may drive some defenders to concede or to settle. And their final aspect of this reasoning was that there was a lack of evidence that the unavailability of quarks in discrimination claims suppressed the number of claims. Well, it's a more learned person than me who wrote that judgment, and but I would respectfully say that there's a chicken and egg there going on, isn't there? So these are significant disincentives for disabled people.
As you've so powerfully illustrated, it's really important to have that representation and that lived experience in all professions and in all aspects of society. So I was wondering if you have any particular advice for disabled people who are considering a career at the bar.
Number one, contact me. I will give you whatever help I can. Number two, I have benefited at 7BR from a huge range of people, both members and colleagues in the clerking room and marketing and admin staff, who have wanted to see me succeed. And whatever success I've managed to achieve has in significant part been down to them. So there may be a perception that the bar is not inclusive. And I have to tell you, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I've had many, many examples outside of chambers where the bar and the courts and judges have not been particularly accessible. But I passionately believe in the goodness of people. And I know from my own experience that people are willing to help. So contact me, speak to your inn, do apply for the grants that the inn give for general scholarships. You've got to have the prerequisites to be a barrister. And the prerequisites are intelligence, a willingness and a capacity to work hard, a willingness to listen, a willingness to check your ego at the door so that you approach cases with humility and you listen, genuinely listen to what the client is telling you so you can understand what the case is. And then a strength of character and nerve to make sure that you can put that case in the most persuasive way, abiding by all ethical considerations. There's a lot to mentally juggle. Make sure that you feel that you can cover those off. If you can cover those off, please don't worry. Well, you can't say don't worry, but please don't be put off by the disability and access parts of this, because we can find workarounds. There are enough barriers for disabled people to face without disabled people themselves thinking, well, how will I do this? How will I do that? And I've got to tell you, I did the same. I thought to myself when I was considering, should I be a barrister or should I be a solicitor? And I thought, well, look, solicitors can sit down. I won't have to have an argument with the judge every time that I need to sit down. And then I thought to myself, well, I'm just creating a barrier here for myself. I'll just tell the judge that I can't stand up for extended periods. And I'm sure most people will accept that. And they have. There's only one time when a coroner in Doncaster said to me that I needed to get to my feet. And then I pointed to the wheelchair and I said, well, you know, and you know, that we got over it. We got over it. And you can't let those things affect you. There are allies for you, and people want you to succeed. I certainly would want you to succeed. And I see it as part of my obligation as a barrister with a disability to ensure that the drawbridge is down and that more disabled people come on, or whatever type of impairment, because the law is better for you in it. Our society is better for you in it. So please give it a shot.
And you are really evidence of that, Gregory. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Ellie.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. For more information and to listen to all our previous episodes, please visit our website.